The speaker.
No.
Okay, I think we'll go ahead and get started right at 8. So I'm Todd Hay, Serge's husband. We live in Tacoma, obviously. Today we're going to talk about economics, energy, and the environment. And let's just go ahead and go to the next slide. So I hope everyone's up for a little bit of math. It's, you know, it's 7 in the evening. We'll get the mathematical cobwebs dusted off and all that. So I am by no means an economist. I'm by no means an energy scientist, nor am I an environmentalist. I'm a systems engineer. I work for a company called the MITRE Corporation. We run what are called federally funded R&D centers for the federal government. We run about 7 of those now for the federal government. So we're kind of like quasi-governmental engineers, almost like a national lab in a lot of ways, but with more of a systems engineering focus as opposed to, say, like a Los Alamos at this, like, nuclear weapons testing or something like that. So I'm generally just an interested citizen on these topics. And so I've just kind of been doing research for my own pastime, and I thought I'd share it with you all. So I'm just going to dive in. So here we go. So a little bit of credit up front. The ideas I'm going to talk about here are really from these three gentlemen that's out there in the web. They have some great videos out there. I highly recommend visiting them. Chris Martinson in particular, he's an extremely dynamic speaker. If you want to see the video, I actually have some of the videos on my laptop. So if this interests you enough that you want to learn more, please let me know. You can certainly watch it on my laptop, or I can give you the URLs for where you can gain access to that. So anyway, so those guys are really the kind of the brain children, if you will, behind all these concepts. I'm merely conveying it to you tonight. So here we go. Okay, so we're going to start right in and talk about the economy, right? The first thing to realize about the economy, right, is our economic system is a growth-based system, right? We always hear we got to grow the economy. We got to grow jobs. We got to grow the economy before we can worry about our long-term debt, right? And the key things about this is that, you know, at any point in the economic system, we always have a lot more debt out there than we have income, right? So we measure income typically by the gross national or gross domestic product, GDP. And we measure debt by the credit market debt. And I'll show you some slides on what those look like. So here's our GDP, right, from about 60 to 2011. A lot of these theories of growth grew out of after World War II. Here's one guy, Robert Solow, Nobel Prize economist from MIT, very famous. And they came up with these theories of debt, or these theories of growth. And the key thing about the growth, go ahead and go to the next slide, is that it's a particular type of growth we're talking about. It's exponential growth. Does anyone have a clue as to what exponential growth is? Kind of, sort of, you remember that stuff back in the day? It goes up quickly, right? This is an equation basically for exponential growth, right? You start out with an initial value, you have a rate of growth, and you have a number of time chunks. So let's go to the next slide. What does that look like? Say you take out a $10,000 loan at 5%, right? After your first year, you know, you tack on 5%, $500. After your second year, you tack on 5% of 10,500. Now you're at 11,025, right? You get a curve that looks like that, grows exponentially, right? That's a key piece of this exponential growth, because you're gonna look at all these systems out there, whether they're economic, whether they're energy systems, or whether they're even environmental systems, they portray economic growth, or they portray exponential growth. That's gonna be a key underpinning of all this. Next slide. So just to give it a little more concreteness, if you will, here's linear growth, right? A nice straight line. That's why we call it linear. And go back one. So you notice here, we're just going up to like 350 is our y-axis now. Let's go to the next slide. I've crunched that way down to 25,000, right? So now what we're seeing, you can't really see too well, can you? At the very bottom there, you have the linear and the exponential growth. In here, we're going out. That's totally cut. I don't
know if I can pull this down.
Keep going up.
There
he goes. Perfect. So I'm doing some measurements out to like 5.6, basically 56 calculations, right? Let's go to the next slide now. When I take it all the way up to 100 calculations, that's the difference between your linear growth, so you get up to about 500, to about 22,000 in exponential growth, okay? So let's go to the next slide. Okay, so here is how much debt we have. Total debt in this country. Government debt, commercial debt, home mortgage debt, you know, credit card debt, auto loans, all that type of stuff. What does that look like, that type of a curve? Next slide. It's an exponential curve, right? basically says we're growing exponentially in our debt levels every year, every day, right? So what I just did there is I fit a curve to that. Mathematical term, a regression term. That R squared value, that's a measurement of your goodness of fit to that to the data. When that says zero, when an R squared equals zero, it means you have no correlation whatsoever. When it says one, you have perfect correlation between the mathematical formula, that for an exponential formula, and the actual data of that. So we have a perfectly exponentially growing debt system in our country, in the world, actually. Next slide. And what's interesting about this is it doubles very quickly, right? So back here in the 70s, or excuse me, 64, we had $1 trillion in total credit market debt in the US. A few years later, it doubled to $2 trillion, all the way up, and you see it doubled basically five times, and we're sitting at $56 trillion worth of debt in this country. Next slide. So that happened in the course of 38 years, right? At least four decades, right? Can you see that little perturbation at the very end there? Mm-hmm. Guess when that occurred? What year is that? 2008. The Great Recession, right? We hit a limit, basically. And we got a little wiggle there. And, you know, some people, if you hear Chris Martinson talk, he's like, we hit a limit, and that's history. You know, we hit the wiggle, and now we don't even know where we're going. It's interesting to hear him talk. I highly recommend it. Very dynamic. But you can see we're already starting to try to grow again. And a lot of that's because the Federal Reserve is pumping, a lot of money into the system via something called quantitative easing. And they're trying to continue to deflate to get money in the economy to get it moving again, right? But as you can see, our economic recovery is still not really going very well. For some people it is, but for I think the vast majority of folks out there, it's not going very well. So, but the real question is, right, we went from $1 trillion to $32 trillion in 38 years, right? And so we're sitting at $56 trillion, so we're coming up to the next doubling of $64 trillion, right? How are we going to double? You know, if we need to maintain this type of a debt curve to really work, for our economy to work, how are we going to double up to, you know, 2 times 56 is $112 trillion? How are you going to double like that over the course of 10, 20 years? I mean, that's going to be next to impossible. But that's what basically is required by our economic system to function properly. Okay, so that's a first sign right there. It's like, wow, we may have a serious problem here, folks, with our fundamental economic system here, because it has to grow, right? Let's go to the next slide.
I think we're beyond having a serious problem. We do have a serious problem.
We do have a serious problem, right? And in a lot of ways, this is kind of stating the obvious in a sense. But, you know, it's an interesting approach of trying to demonstrate how do these three major kind of areas, the economics, the energy, and the environment, really kind of relate together. And they all share these very exponentially growing systems. Here's kind of another calculation. So now what I'm showing you is basically the credit market debt. So this is our debt, basically divided by our income, right? By our GDP. And, okay, you get this big spike. That's Great Depression, right? We come down through here, World War II, AC. And then this is about the time when Robert Solow and those guys did all the publishing on the growth-based systems in the 50s, right? And we started a growth pattern here. Well, look what happened when we hit about 1982. It just started shooting straight up, right? We started basically pumping a whole bunch of money out there, and we got this huge debt-to-income ratio again, right? So again, it's like, how do you ever come away from that? And what's interesting is when you hear Chris Martin's talk, he talks about people, you know, in the history of all the countries that we have out there, right? There's only one country that's ever been able to get over, come back from like a ratio of 260 or more, 260 at that level, and that was Great Britain. And they did it back after at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, and the only reason they were able to do it was because they were dismantling their entire war machine, and because they had the Industrial Revolution come along. And so it was this massive engine for growth. And that was the only country that's ever been able to come out of a debt load that's that high. And so you start wondering, wow, that doesn't look too good. So let's just keep going.
Is there a factor of what that debt money is used for?
No. I mean, you can certainly break it down. That, like the $56 trillion, if we go back a slide,
Let's go back one more slide, actually. So here, right, so we're at 56 trillion. How does it break out, right? I mean, about 10 or 11 trillion are mortgages out there. The big investment banks probably have another, it's like 7 or 8 trillion dollars of the debt. Obviously, the federal government has a sizable $16 trillion of debt. I don't remember how the other breaks out as well. It's not so much, as far as I can tell, I don't think it's so much kind of the division between the types of debt. It's more just that all the debt is trying to grow in this exponential fashion. And that's really where the challenge comes in, is how do you grow so much, such that your system needs that growth, right? So
you don't think there's, the focus after World War II was on infrastructure, there was a focus on taking care of people.
Right.
And now we're, you know, we're really focused on war,
right.
and making money,
right.
False debt kind of situation.
You know, I would love to say yes, but I'm not sure. To me, it just seems like the system wants to grow this way. And, you know, it's almost like this amorphous, you know, big Borg out there. But it does appear, just from looking at this pure data set, it does appear it wants to grow that way exponentially. You even see, you know, after that little blip in 2008, you see it wanting to try to grow again, right?
Yeah.
It looks like yet another exponential curve starting to emerge there. But again, you just look at it and you're like, 56 trillion, like, we need to double that again to $112 trillion worth of debt now. Over the course of, you know, these are roughly about 10 years, give or take. So by, you know, what, 2023 or 2025, we're going to have $12 trillion of debt. I don't know how you ever, I just don't know how that would work. I don't know how you'd sustain that.
How much of that is personal debt?
I don't have the breakdown. I'd have to go back and look.
People borrowing money from the banks to buy a house, buy a car, etc.
Like I said, the mortgages out there about 10, 11 trillion. You know, obviously the federal government's about 16 or so. The big investment banks are, I think, about 7. I kind of forget how the rest of it breaks out. But I mean, I could certainly go back and look at the numbers if you're really interested. So let's keep going. Let's go to the next one. So that was kind of the energy component of it. So you kind of see, hey, we've got these interesting debt and income type thing. Now let's turn to the energy side of the house, right? And in particular, I'm going to talk about kind of the oil story, right? Because you look at oil, and really that's what's driven the globalization effort out there, right? We have cheap oil enables worldwide transport. So all these goods, whether it's your computer produced in China, you know, I bet half the goods around here are probably produced in China, right? Books or whatnot. Cheap oil, right? Pure and simple, it's cheap oil. And we have a lot of other technologies out there. We have things like natural gas and all that, but it's not a replacement for oil yet because of the commercial, you know, the transport capabilities. That's the key problem. So you hear about all these things. Heck, there was an Atlantic Monthly just had an article, we'll never run out of oil, right? You see some of these magazines saying, wow, today's oil is discovered the biggest we've ever seen. You've probably heard of the Bakken or Bakken, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but the Bakken play in North Dakota, this huge, you know, Shell fracking capability. You probably heard about that in Marcellus Shell in like the Pennsylvania region as well, with natural gas. It's a lot of oil, but let's go through a little bit and we'll see how much oil it is. And is it good oil? Is it, you know, quality starts becoming just as important as the quantity. I'll show you why in a second. Okay, so this is a couple of things here, but I really want you to look at the red line. The red line basically represents in U.S. for oil production, our oil production rates, right? So we hit peak production in 72. What's interesting, though, is we hit peak discovery, which is, you know, when they do oil, you know, you can produce it, but when do you actually first discover the wells, right? And so it takes a while to develop and get the production going and all that. There's about a 40-year lag from the time we hit peak discovery of oil wells to the time we hit peak production. So we hit peak discovery sometime in the 30s in the U.S.
Wasn't it 1970 that we had a gas rationing?
Mm-hmm.
So 2 years later we had peak production. Isn't that interesting?
Okay, so we have peak production, again, about a 40-year lag from the time you had peak discovery to peak production. Let's go to the next slide. So the next one is our worldwide discoveries now, right? And these have been basically binned by decade. And the next slide I'll show you where they actually show you the yearly route. But basically you see the biggest decade of discoveries occurred in 1960. And what did they say about the lag between discovery and production?
40 years.
On a 40-year lag, right? So, yeah, not a good thing, basically. So we've been on the decline ever since in terms of the discovery. And production is basically it. It's actually, well, we'll get to that slide. Let's go to the next slide. This is just another slide of the other one. You'll notice I first pulled this chart the other night, and I scratched my head. I'm like, wait a second. I thought the peak discovery was in the 60s, right? I see that huge peak right ahead. What that previous slide, they basically binned them by decade, right? This is showing you every single year slice. So basically that previous slide took those 10 years and just chunked it into one bin and put it up. So you see all these high slices right there. That together gave you that 1960 was the biggest decade of discovery of oil. But since then, you can see it's been a pretty fast decline. Remember I talked about exponential growth? Well, basically what you're seeing here is exponential decay. Right, just as fast as you grew it, now you're losing it. Okay, let's go to the next slide. So, what do we see today? These are basically our worldwide consumption and production levels, right? So, basically, I'm sorry, a little bit of weird math. These are reported out in thousands of barrels per day. So, basically, we're seeing about 89 million barrels of oil produced and consumed daily. A lot of oil, right? But we're basically keeping up with it right now. Let's go to the next slide. This one should cause concern, though. This is from the International Energy Agency, which is kind of a big governing body out there, the UN body. And so what they are predicting out here is they're kind of, you know, shooting out to 2035 and trying to say, okay, what do we know? What are the proven reserves? What are the unproven reserves? Check out this light blue piece right here. Fields yet to be found. It's kind of like the leap of faith, right? We got to get up and look at our numbers up here. The previous slide was that we're about at 90 million, 89 million barrels, which is sitting right up in there. You know, you're pretty close, basically right there as well. Way out to 2035, right? So the question then is, what happens? Is that even there? We don't know if that's there, right? So it, to me, it's like, wow, that's another huge sign that we've got a real serious issue going on right here. So let's go to the next slide.
Electric cars will take care of it.
Electric cars will take care of it.
No question about that.
So here's a challenge. So that a lot of people actually take that very seriously. Like, that's no kidding. The truth.
Talk to me about the grid.
Well, the challenge with it though is just your spent infrastructure costs, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I mean, we have got so much infrastructure in gas. The fueling stations, the distribution network, everything is gas basically, right? I mean, we've got a small percentage that's electric, obviously. It'll continue growing. But the time to actually build out your infrastructure, I mean, we're talking decades before we're even going to, you know, parallel our gas capability. And then that's assuming you can do it right. But now you get into all your battery issues. And I'll talk kind of a couple of the end slides about your extraction costs for, you know, things like lead and whatnot. And it just doesn't look like a pretty picture. It doesn't seem like a real viable large-scale solution right now. So, yeah, there are a lot of issues. Okay, so we kind of talked about the oil quantity. Now you got to talk about oil quality, because we do hear a lot about, hey, we're becoming Saudi America, right? We've got all this fracking in the Bakken play and whatnot, or in the, I think, the Eagle Ford play, which is in North Texas. The challenge is it's costing more and more. So this shows us our energy return on investment. We see how much energy does it cost to put in versus how much you get out, right? When you get down to the one level, then you're in trouble, right? It's costing you as much energy putting in as you get energy out. And basically, this looks at things like, you know, the energy density of these different types of fuels. So oil has actually a very high energy density. So back when we started pumping stuff, and you had these, you know, gushers, you tap and oil would come shooting out, you had a very high ROI. You had like 100-to-1. Return on investment. It was cheap and easy oil. The era of cheap and easy oil is totally gone. We're in the fracking technology, right? We're drilling down, you know, vertically, then we're shooting horizontal wells in, or pipes in there, or bores in there, and we're basically spewing a bunch of water and pretty nasty chemicals into these shell deposits down there and trying to basically frack them to break inside those things to release oil that's basically bound up in the rock. And then we pull that back out. It's like 3 million gallons of water for those fracking operations. So all of a sudden, now you got 3 million gallons of contaminated water. What do you do with that stuff? I mean, it's just a mess. So anyways, where are we? So we started out in the 30s, you know, we had 100 to 1. You come down here to the 70s, okay, we already dropped like 40 to 1. Technology is getting more expensive. It costs more to do our exploration, whatnot. Now you come over here to, where do I want to say, domestic oil 2000. You know, we're probably 10, 12 to 1, something like that. Let's go to the next slide. Now you hear about the oil shale, the fracking stuff in particular. Look at those two estimates on the right. That's basically what they estimate we are at the wellhead. This is the amount of energy, you know, energy in versus energy out at the wellhead now. Now, if you go to the next slide, this is actually once you've done the refining of the fuel, done the gas, right? You're at 1.4 and 1.5. You're basically not even breaking even at that point. You're putting as much energy in as it takes, as energy you're getting out. So it's almost a question of why even do it, right? At some point, the oil companies won't even be profitable to be able to support doing this, right? So next slide.
So why is it such a hot item then?
Right now they are profitable. They're able to kick it out and still make a profit on it. And so they'll keep going as long as they can at that level. At what point, and it, no one totally knows, right? I mean, these are kind of best estimates, but at what point do you break it where it's not profitable, right? I mean, and you kind of see, you look at the technologies, whether it's the fracking, or like the deep water horizon stuff where you're drilling down 26,000 feet and whatnot. It's clearly the era is cheap and easy. It's definitely, you know, far gone.
So what it probably says is if there were any environmental regulations on fracking, it would be not profitable right away.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it would certainly be a big hindrance to them. I mean, so you see a real resistance towards, you know, having to... I'm not a good speaker on the fracking in terms of the environmental regulations. I'm not sure what
there are none.
Yeah, that's my understanding right now. But
so why don't can't you just continue to raise the price of oil?
Well, that's probably what will happen. And
the profitability.
Yeah, you could, but I guess the real question becomes, you know, when we look back there, right, we saw that 89 million barrels per day. Production and consumption, right? It's really when you get a substantial delta between your availability and your demand, right? Your supply and demand curves, effectively. And so, you know, what happens when all of a sudden we're a million barrels short per day? And what a lot of people theorize is that, oh, you know, a country like Norway is going to say, we're nationalizing our oil reserves now. We're not putting them on the, you know, open market. And then all of a sudden, people are fearful that that's going to cause a huge run. And all of a sudden, everyone's going to start, you know, lock up the reserves and not trade on open market. And then who knows what happens then. But, I sure don't know. I mean, it's kind of anyone's guess at that point, but that's one of the big concerns out there. So that was kind of the, you know, we've talked about the economics, we've talked about the energy piece. I'll spend just a few slides talking about the environmental piece as well. So, you know, some folks may or may not be global warming, you know, climate change believers or whatnot, but you should be. I'll tell you that. Pretty much the science is pretty consistent about climate change. You got to obviously get the politics aside, but when you really start looking at the data, there are some very disturbing trends. So here's just the carbon emissions trend, right? And this is primarily, you know, this is carbon. This gets back to some of the carbon dioxide trends, right? The CO2 stuff, which is really not the most harmful of the greenhouse gases. The real scary one is when you get methane release, because that's about 5 times as potent for a greenhouse gas as the carbon dioxide. But so we see our trends here as well. What does that trend look like?
Well,
it's exceedingly exponential, doesn't it?
The economic.
Yeah, it's just very disturbing.
Is that coincidence or?
No, that's just pure data. Mm-hmm. It's just pure empirical data right there. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I don't know. Does nature like exponential? I don't know. I'm not going to try to impose any meaning on that. That's just looking at pure tons, that, you know, metric tons of carbon that you're releasing basically per year. Next slide. You can also look at surface temperatures, right? And so this one has basically been normalized. They're trying to show a delta where they basically averaged up from like 1950 to, I want to say it's 79, it says up there in the blurry text. And they average and they start to say, hey, how much of a delta are we getting kind of up and down historically? And these are, again, using kind of four, you know, good leading sources of data, people who've done different types of measurements on this. So again, you're seeing, you know, a pretty good climb there. The real concern is if we get up to like the 3 or 4, and this is worldwide temperature increase, right? Land temperature increase. So if you get up, you know, 3, 4, a lot of people are even postulating we could get up to like 6 degrees of warming. And when you get to that point, that's when you really get concerned, because you also get these self-reinforcing natural systems, right? At 6 degrees, you start melting the permafrost in the Arctic. And when you start melting the permafrost, permafrost has a ton of methane in it. Remember what I said about methane? It's 5 times as potent as a greenhouse gas as carbon dioxide. So when you get to that point, all of a sudden, you know, you start releasing methane. Well, that warms even more. Well, then you start releasing more methane because you're just warming it even more. You get this self-reinforcing system. And those get those can start spinning fast. Tacoma Narrows Bridge, anyone? Remember back in the 40s? You got harmonic motion going on, basically.
Gallop and Gertie,
exactly. I mean, you saw that thing. I mean, it just looked like a rubber band or something. That's a self-reinforcing system is what you had going on there. So it's data you look at and you're kind of like, it's definitely a disturbing trend. Next slide. One could also look at the polar ice cap extents, right? And this one, this is obviously North Pole. And so where are the disturbing trends here, right? One is Greenland, because you're actually on land, right? And then Antarctica, because you're actually on land, right? I mean, this is obviously just ice over the sea. So heck, you know, a lot of people are saying, hey, we'll have open sea lanes, right? Think of all the economic benefits for that. So you can bring your oil around cheaper that way, right? There's some serious irony there. The real concern is when things start melting over Greenland and Antarctica, which they are, because all of a sudden you have an increase of liquids now, right? You're actually adding to the ocean content, basically, and then that's when the levels rise. So, next slide.
Don't they have data that said this happened about 4 or 5 million years ago, too? The melting and heating?
So they're always like, you always have these like glacial trends. Mm-hmm. And whatnot. You can go back to the polar ice core data, which goes like 400,000 years old, right?
Yeah.
You can go back and look at it. You can see very kind of sinusoidal trends. It's like a sine wave. And then you see these last like 150 years, kind of industrial revolution years, and you see this trending up from there. Now, you know, no one knows for sure, right? But the trending is definitely different than the rest of the data that you see. Here's another one. This one actually comes right from Chris Martinson. I mentioned him earlier. This was talking about looking at like just, okay, we talked about kind of, you know, the energy and we talked about the economics, but this was actually looking at like precious metals, right? Copper. We'll talk about copper here in a second in the mine just right across the way. Copper, gold, silver, you know, things we build electronics with, things we do electrical wiring with, all that sort of stuff. And he was just projecting out, you know, a lot of these folks are saying, okay, we're growing at kind of an extraction of 2% per year. And they started looking at, okay, what, you know, what's our rate of depletion here? What are our proven reserves out there? I don't know how much I buy this one. I'll be perfectly blunt. I'm not sure I do. Because some of these things, I noticed he didn't bring copper on here, which because copper, they actually project out like a 4-year range.
Makes a good case for recycling, though, doesn't it?
It does make a big case for recycling, absolutely. And so one really starts thinking about, you know, especially you go to some of these things where you see all these like cell phones like just thrown in bins and whatnot, you're like, wow, how do we actually do the extraction and get that material back out? Let's go to the next slide. Okay, so I thought I'd throw this up there, bring it kind of local here. So Holden, you know, they're mining daily about 2,000 tons of ore per day, which at about a 1% ore grade. Which means, you know, if you bring out 100 tons of ore, you're getting 1 ton of copper, basically, out of that. Once you, you know, smelter it and go through all that whole process. Here's another one, Bingham Canyon in Utah. which is, they claim is the world's largest open pit mine. It's about 2.5 miles across. It's about 1,000 feet down. And they're looking at going by another 500 feet down and extending it even a lot larger. But so their daily ore is 150,000 tons, but they have an overburden, which is just to get to that ore, they have to pull out another 330,000 tons of material. So they're there pulling out 500,000 tons of material daily. Their ore grade is 0.53. Part of the concern is that, you know, back in the day when we first started mining, you'd get ore, or you'd get copper that was like solid copper, right? Nuggets. That's a 5,500 pound nugget of copper. And then all of a sudden it starts shrinking, right? Because all of a sudden, you know, and that, you know, that's not, you're not an ore grade of 0.53%, you know, I'm not even sure what the ore grade of that thing is, but that's very high. It's like almost solid copper. You know, and then they start getting smaller nuggets, and pretty soon you're at that open pit mine, right, where you're having to extract large quantities of ore, actually, just to break that all down and to extract the pure copper content. So it's just a disturbing trend. I'd throw that out there. It's you know, how much longer can you do that type of extraction processes before you run out? Next slide. I think I'm getting close again. That's really it. So a couple things I want to leave you with was, the first one was, okay, so you look at Holden, you kind of say, how are we complicit in doing this, in this whole system, right? You know, whether it's, bringing stuff in by ship, you know, your daily activities, what are you doing? You know, when you do things, are you basically embedded, you know, are you using this system and not even realizing you're using the system? That'd be, you know, one maybe point of discussion we can have. We've got about 10, 15 minutes left. The second one would be, what are things Holden's doing that are kind of countering this, right? And I can think of a few things right off the top of my head. You're the hydroelectric dam, or the hydroelectric power, right? It's a localized power solution. It's a great solution, except for in the winter, maybe. But there might be some alternatives, right?
Do a lot of conservation in the winter.
Yeah, I mean, clearly conservation is one solution. I mean, there might be some interesting storage technologies you look at. It might be a little pricey, but, you know, there are, you know, people are doing things like hydrolysis, and then the fuel cell technology, once you've separated the hydrogen and oxygen and you recombine it, you actually produce electricity from that. I mean, those are pretty intensive projects, but those are things, you know, you could start looking at. I mean, even the fact of kind of bringing folks here together and kind of, I think, operating locally as a community is a real, really big change from a lot of what this is talking about. I mean, this is driven globalization, right? The economic growth, the kind of the energy growth and all that, and the fact that we can get cheap goods and parts from anywhere in the world, right, very quickly. But even, you know, working with Janice went on the garden this morning, well, how about having, you know, have a day when you just eat purely from the garden, local.
The really sad part about Holden right now is the fact that the carbon footprint from the mine remediation activity is going to totally swap any of the footprint saving that we've realized in the last 50 years.
Right.
Because the amount of carbon that's being expended with all of the equipment that they're using right now is just astronomical. I mean,
right.
There's an exponential curve.
The food coming into the trucks on the road, the whole kit and caboodle.
Yeah. But, you know, so I kind of just want to walk you through that story. Would certainly open up for discussion, comments, thoughts. You know, tell me, hey, Todd, you're full of whatever. You know, that's not right. I believe this. We're going this way. You know, a lot of folks, I think, you see some of the data, and you're kind of like, yeah, right, whatever, don't believe it. I don't know. I think you need to maybe sit with it sometimes. If you really take an objective look at the data, it's compelling to me at least. And I think it's worthwhile to have a discussion. Is this accurate, right? What are we missing? I mean, these are this is empirical data with some scientific, you know, analysis and whatnot. And you know, we will learn a lot more, right? We're missing variables. Okay, we got that wrong. This is, you know, bad. This is better, whatnot. But we need to be having that type of discussion. And I don't think, honestly, as a country, we're doing that very well at all. Right? We're in a state of denial. We're kind of like, we'll just keep pumping. We're going to frack, frack, frack. You know, we got all the oil we want, all the natural gas we want. Well, do we? We may have, you know, our quantity may be going back up a bit. It's never going to get to our peak. I'm pretty confident of that. But the quality is going way down, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a lot more from an extraction cost. So go ahead, please.
Do any of those authors reference, like, so we have all these systems that are keeping us pretty firmly rooted
right.
in this destruction. Are there any like linchpins that they point at that say, if we as a society do this, this, and this, we can shift the curve? Do they offer anything?
They do. I mean, like Richard, so Odom is, I think Odom's dead now. He was kind of in the 70s, but Richard Heinberg and Chris Martinson, they definitely talk about, okay, these are things we need to do for kind of more of a solutions-oriented approach. And a lot of it's, you know, kind of bring things back local, right? It's kind of like the reverse of the industrial approach. It's bringing it local. It's reverse of, you know, globalization. It's doing it local. And so that's why, you know, I do kind of point to something like Holden saying, hey, you're trying to do it local. You're trying to, you know, live more communally, you're trying to share resources, you're trying to perhaps grow some of your own food. You know, he talked about, and you I really highly recommend you go to Chris's site and all that, but, you know, he used to be like a big vice president in New York or of some financial thing and whatnot, living in a big, you know, McMansion in Connecticut and kind of living the American Wall Street dream, if you will. He sold it all. He bought a rural place in Massachusetts. He's raising chickens now. I mean, he's doing kind of all the off-the-land type stuff or off-the-grid type stuff. And so, you know, I think a lot of it, so, yeah, they point to things like that. They point to saying, hey, we need to have a national dialogue. We need to do all that. It just doesn't seem palatable, though. Like, you talk climate change with people at a national level, and it just, you know, it just shuts down
yeah.
with people. And so, and a lot of it's because it's just not concrete for people. How do I, and it's so big. And so it's like, okay, it's like, I don't remember who said, but, you know, the mine remediation is going to totally overwhelm what Holden could do in terms of your carbon footprint. True. Doesn't mean you shouldn't do it anyways, right?
Right, yeah. And I totally value and understand that, like, bring it local, the individual, and consumers can slowly shift what's being sold, how things are packaged, whatever. But there are so many policies and like, politics in place, I think,
right.
that like, not... Like moving to a country farm is a luxury that most people couldn't do.
Right.
And, yeah.
Well, it's okay. He moved to a country farm after he made his millions.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, Austin, you're exactly right. Oh, yes, now we're going to go live off the farm. Right.
And we have
sir.
One thing you can see right now, it's happened the last 3 years, is the cost of doing business, which is fuel related,
mm-hmm.
has affected a lot of recreational industries.
Mm.
The amount of people flying on a personal level has dropped.
Right.
Business may be different. Cruise ships, all of those types of things have dropped tremendously because of the cost of fuel.
Yeah.
Even
yeah.
though it's cheap, but it's gone up type of thing. So.
Yeah. And, you know, I kind of hoped, you know, when Obama came in, I mean, I'll show my liberal colors right here. I'm, you know, having come from Massachusetts and whatnot, but... I kind of hope that there was no kidding going to be some national dialogue on climate change.
Didn't happen.
Didn't happen. Politics, you know, all of a sudden we got into the debt issue, and then I forget how many other things got in the way again. You know, it's just like, my goodness, are we ever going to have a serious dialogue on this? But then I see countries like, you know, like Germany. So we lived in Germany for 5 years, and when I went back, you know, a year or two ago, and all of a sudden you just saw solar panels everywhere. They did a huge infrastructure investment into solarizing the country. And you know, a lot of people are like, oh, Germany, they, you know, that's middle of Europe, right? That's cloudy and all that. Well, they did it. And they're producing a substantial portion. I mean, they're trying to decommission all their nuclear facilities, and they're trying to go over to renewable, truly renewable resources. And to me, it's like, do you ever have the national will to do it? You even look like something like China, right? I mean, China's a huge polluter. But their consumption of oil is just growing like crazy. They want to, you know, as their standard of living rises, they want to drive cars just like the rest of us. But what's interesting about China is that because they're, you know, this kind of communist group, they can kind of dictate what national policy is without having to get a legislature to agree to it. So they don't have nearly the infighting and bickering that they to get things approved. So they're doing like massive investments into. Battery technologies and electrical cars and stuff like that, whereas we're not able to do it quite so much, or as effectively as they are. And you know, China, but they're also, oh man, they're ripping coal out of the, you know, they're just going everywhere trying to get energy because they recognize, hey, we've got a real problem for a huge population. I think you were next.
One of the most interesting discussions I heard on fracking was from a biologist who was talking about how they're discovering the biology of way down under the ground where we always thought was just kind of dead, you know, there's no biology going on there. Well, you discover all these vents in the middle of the ocean and in land that there is stuff going on. And she's saying, what if we are polluting the very roots of what we see on top? Damaging that, doing who knows what to it, and she was saying, yeah, I don't know what's going on. We don't understand this. We didn't understand the whole nuclear thing when we did Hanford, and we're working on...
Yeah, we're still working on that, right?
Yeah, and talking about penetrating down through these strata, and yeah, you seal it up pretty well when you leave it, but 10 years from now or 30 years from now, is that a puncture wound going down into it that is just going to make this place a biological dead zone?
Yeah.
It was scary to listen to her, and she was saying, yeah, I certainly can't say this is going to happen. We do not understand this at all, but just raising this big red flag that, boy, maybe we should go really slowly because we may be annihilating huge areas of land and making them.
But have we ever done that? Have we ever gone slowly when we get these?
Yeah, when there's cheap energy to be had.
When there's money involved.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's really hard.
Yeah, it was enlightening and frightening to listen
to.
Well, your first discussion was in regard to economics. You were showing the graphs.
Right.
And what you're presenting is that our economy is running on our constant supply or creation of debt.
Right.
Okay, who profits a debt economy?
Well, I mean, we all use it, right? I mean, every loan you take out. So in a sense, we're all using it. I mean, I have a house mortgage, so I'm using it. Couldn't get a house.
Which industry really profits the most from
the 1% that have the money?
Sure.
They don't take out loans.
Sure. It's the banksters.
It's the banks.
The banksters.
Yeah. But not all banks are like that, right? I mean, there certainly are. I mean, I've moved all of our money into, you know, localized, you know, savings
credit
and loan type of things. Yeah, credit unions, stuff like that.
Yeah, and you do that, and next thing, I've done that, I'm old enough now that I've done that a couple of times, and guess what happens? A bigger bank
prices
it and buys up the
yeah.
local bank.
Hey, I mean, it's hard. I mean, you have to be diligent about it and kind of keep pressing it, but...
Until we're willing to get out of our cars and drive our cars, then you'll see this continued relationship between oil and oil.
I think the thing that concerns me so much about all this is that, you know, when I started looking at this, I started just looking at these curves, right? And you know, you just hear growth out there, and everyone talks about growth as it's like the salvation, right? We're going to grow our way out of this recession. And at what point does growth not work?
It looks like it's about there, right?
Yeah, it's about there, it appears to me. And so, it's so rooted, and you hear it everywhere, and it's just taken us like, and you hear from both parties, right? I mean, everyone's like, yeah, we're going to grow this, grow jobs, we got to grow the economy, all this, you know, we're going to grow. And it's like, when are we going to have a real dialogue and say, no, growth is not the right way to get out of this stuff. It's just going to dig us deeper.
Dissent is like failure. It's tantamount to failure. It's like the system doesn't work if it doesn't.
Right.
And so, that's the glass ceiling that people can't go through, it seems.
Right.
But one of the terribly important things is, again, is what is that debt going to pay for? And if it's going to pay for destruction, meaning
right.
war,
right.
If it's going to create false things of value so that you have the speculative debt kind of
right.
thing, and you have people who are making money,
right.
whether they lose or not,
right.
That's a destructive kind of, there is no possible future value out of it. What we saw after World War II was a tremendous focus on the infrastructure, the things
right.
that benefit our society,
right. Right.
and there was really healthy growth.
Right.
That's my concern.
We're growing, but we're not even growing in the right spaces.
Yeah.
Exactly.
We're looking about that far ahead, and if it makes money, it's good.
Right.
For me, it makes
right.
money for me. It doesn't matter what it does to those people out there.
Right.
So it's just a very destructive focus on debt.
And just greed, right? Just pure, plain greed, in my opinion.
The whole idea that it makes money, it's good. And so, you know, what do you sell people cigarettes and whatever else it is that will kill you.
Right.
And, yeah, right. I got my money.
Do you think China has a real problem? They do not know what to do with their older folks that are turning 65, 70 years old. We have 10,000 people a day turning 65 in the United States for the next 12 or 13 years. The economic impact of that healthcare thing of your whole economic thing, people have no idea what that's going to happen to that type of thing. It's just another factor of the U.S. economy.
Right.
So that wasn't even brought into discussion today, which I can understand, but it's going to be a factor.
Yeah, you bet.
But once again, it's a valuable cost. It's a thing of value. It's a caring for people.
Well,
what I'm afraid of, we're saying is that more and more, well, those people, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, your policies are totally a reflection of your nation's values, right?
Yeah, so if those people have poor health care, oh, that's okay. They just didn't work hard like I did, all that kind of junk.
Well, thank you for coming. So tomorrow, the next couple of days, I'm going to do a deep dive on some of the economics. I'm going to look at kind of the housing crisis and the Great Recession piece. The next day, we're going to do kind of the environment. We're going to look at industrial agriculture and some soil depletion and things of that nature. And then the final day, we're going to look at, going to do some fracking, a little more deeper dive on fracking. But I'm also, each day, I'm going to try to weave in some kind of localized stuff. So like, you'll have to come to the events and I'll show you.
Don't give it away.